This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that we take one of those issues you feel you need to know about, bring together some of the top minds on the subject, and take 28 minutes to get briefed up on it. And you can subscribe to the podcast via BBC Sounds, and it'd be really helpful if you tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider. Our question today, just how high are the Brexit stakes for the Republic of Ireland and her northern neighbour? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. A car bomb went off last Saturday night on the streets of a British city. That city was Londonderry. And it was a reminder that things in Northern Ireland can be, to say the least, rather more fraught than in the rest of the United Kingdom. And although the situation there barely figured in the 2016 referendum campaign, it's come to loom large indeed in the business of getting a Brexit deal. So this week we're asking, when it comes to Brexit, what is actually at stake on the island of Ireland? Step inside the briefing room to find out. It was hardline Republicans who exploded that car bomb in the centre of Londonderry. No one was hurt, but it revived memories of the bad, bloody old days of the Troubles, which killed more than 3,600 people, and the potential for unresolved tensions to reignite. But was it also, as some believe, a sign that Brexit is straining the hard-won peace in Northern Ireland? To answer that question, I was joined by Peter Taylor, a BBC journalist who's covered Northern Ireland and terrorism for nearly 50 years. Peter Taylor, how high is the risk thought to be of a return to significant violence in Northern Ireland?
The bomb at the weekend, which is thought to have been the result of a new IRA operation, was important because it was one of the first car bombs that we've seen carried out by dissident organisations, and the visual images of it that drew national attention to dissidents and in particular the new IRA. I don't think we're looking at the danger of a renewed level of violence. There has been a sustained level of violence at various levels since the Good Friday Agreement and well before. Notably, after the Good Friday Agreement, there was a major split in the IRA. Those who did not agree with the IRA entering politics formed a group called the Real IRA. The Real IRA subsequently morphed into what we now refer to as the New IRA. So the violence has always been there.
And presumably the Provisional IRA had a very much bigger hinterland with regard to support from political Republicans. Does the New IRA have that kind of hinterland?
No. The new IRA does have a degree of support. If it didn't have that degree of support, then it wouldn't be able to carry out any operations effectively. I remember going to a ceremony last year that was run by what is regarded as being the political wing of the new IRA, this organisation called CERU. I reckon there were about 2,000 supporters there. Now, that doesn't mean that they are all active supporters, military supporters of a campaign, but the fact there were around 2,000 Republicans supporting dissident activity indicates that they do have a degree of support. They are looking to build that support, and they are going to use the issue of Brexit and the border as a means of doing that.
Peter Taylor, what's your understanding of the impact of the Brexit discussion and process on hardline Republicans?
Hardline Republicans are always looking for an issue. What Brexit and the border offers is a level of support amongst people who are already disillusioned with the devolved government at Stormont, and there is no devolved government at Stormont. That again plays into the hands of the dissidents who say that the IRA and Sinn Féin sold out. What have we got from it? Answer, nothing. There's no government. It's chaos. The only way to achieve the Republican goal, and still the IRA and Sinn Féin's goal of a United Ireland, is by the use of armed force, what they call armed struggle. I interviewed George Hamilton, the Chief Constable of the Police Service of Northern Ireland, the PSNI, last year, and I asked him about the issue of Brexit and the border.
We wouldn't want to see anything that looks like physical infrastructure at the border, primarily because we assess that that could symbolically become the focus of attention and targeting by violent dissident Republican groups.
When I was at a dissident event last year, I remember listening to a dissident spokesperson called Patrick Carty, who made it quite clear how they regarded the border as being, you know, a heaven-sent opportunity to progress their so-called armed struggle and their political fight to try and reunify Ireland.
Brexit has the potential to break up the British state, and as such, it offers Irish Republicans an opportunity to realise our first great objective, the ending of the British occupation and the reunification of the Irish nation. And as history teaches us, it will inevitably stoke the fires of resistance against British rule in Ireland.
The way in which I recall my history, the activities of the Provisional IRA were part of the reason for the strength of loyalist paramilitaries. Have they completely gone away? Could they be brought back in a situation of a crisis?
I think they could. The UDA, the UFF, the UVF, that alphabet soup of acronyms for loyalist paramilitaries, they've still got weapons. I think if the new IRA's campaign were to really take off, then I wouldn't be surprised to see a loyalist reaction.
Let's talk very briefly about the reaction of our own security establishment. At what level of threat do they rate the situation currently, both in Northern Ireland and from Northern Ireland to the rest of the United Kingdom?
MI5 have said consistently for the past few years that the threat from dissident organisations, which includes, of course, the new IRA, is severe. The threat from dissident Republicans and their activity here in Great Britain is regarded as moderate. So there is a distinction. The reason why the new IRA is so dangerous and poses such a threat is that the leadership, which is a combined leadership of dissidents, consists of a number of senior former members of the IRA who are hardened, experienced. The intelligence agencies have been successful so far in stopping those kind of attacks. If they were able to attack targets here in England in particular, then the threat level would be raised from moderate to severe.
Peter Taylor, suggesting that though we're far away from the worst of the troubles, the potential exists for lower level, though violent, strife. But there are other Brexit challenges, especially economic ones. John Campbell is BBC Northern Ireland's economics and business editor. John Campbell, for people who don't know Northern Ireland, how healthy is the economy there and who are the big employers?
Northern Ireland tends to underperform the UK average. It's been doing a little bit better in recent years, but it's still a reasonably low-wage economy. It has quite high levels of economic inactivity, so that's people not in the labour market, they're not looking for a job. Manufacturing is more important than the UK average. The largest section of manufacturing is food production, so agriculture is more important in Northern Ireland than in other parts of the UK. There are some, if you like, more highly productive industries such as aerospace. So you have a mix of agriculture, of course, like any modern economy, it's dominated by services, some higher value manufacturing, and then some, if you like, lower margin manufacturing as well.
What was the business view of Brexit?
Essentially, the business view around Brexit is that no deal would be the worst possible outcome for Northern Ireland, particularly because our biggest export market is the Republic of Ireland, and it would immediately create new barriers to trade with that market. And so for that reason, the main business groups here were behind Theresa May's deal. They were saying, back this deal with the backstop, it would be good for Northern Ireland.
The dreaded word backstop has now been used. So
yeah.
Remind us what the backstop actually is and how it's supposed to work.
The reason we have a backstop is because the British and Irish governments and the EU want to make sure the Irish border is just as frictionless as it is now. The reason that border is so frictionless is because both parts of Ireland are members of the customs union and the single market. So ultimately, what the policy seeks to do is to replicate that frictionless border, even if the UK was to leave the customs union and the single market. The preference is to do that through some big overarching deal. But if that's not possible, then we have the backstop. And what the backstop would involve is the whole of the UK effectively staying in the EU's customs union. So there's no need for any customs checks on the Irish border. And Northern Ireland alone would stay in the EU's single market for goods, so therefore you wouldn't have to have any regulatory checks on the Irish border.
Let's suppose that we were living in the world of the backstop. What would that mean economically for Northern Ireland?
Well, some of those business groups who support the backstop say it would in fact give Northern Ireland the best of both worlds. And so Northern Ireland businesses could get their goods into the single market in essentially the same way they do today, but businesses in other parts of the UK would face new barriers. So let's say, for example, you could have a shipment of Welsh lamb or Scottish beef going into the EU. That would have to go through a specified border inspection post. In 100% of shipments, the documentary material would need to be checked. There would need to be identity checks. And a high portion of those shipments would also be subject to physical checks. So somebody having to look in the back of the lorry just to check what's in there. By contrast, Northern Ireland products would just sail through into the EU exactly as they do today. No new checks, no new controls. So that would be a clear advantage if somebody is wanting to export from the UK. Well, they would choose a Northern Ireland product because they're going to have none of those checks or controls which, say, a Welsh or Scottish product would.
Doesn't that mean that UK businesses might want to relocate in Northern Ireland?
That's certainly something which the Scottish government latched onto very quickly. Nicola Sturgeon saying that it could be damaging for Scottish industry because if you were a business elsewhere in the UK, or if you were an outside investor and you were to say, right, where do we want to put our factory in order that we can service both the UK market and the EU single market? Well, the answer would clearly be you put it in Northern Ireland because there are no barriers to trade. And that just raises another important aspect around the backstop, is that the UK government has pledged that businesses in Northern Ireland would not face any new barriers to selling their products into the rest of the UK. So that means the UK government has said Northern Ireland businesses can continue to sell into us, and because of the single market rules, they can continue to sell into the EU.
That'd be pretty good for the Northern Irish economy. And yet that's precisely the situation that the major party represented in Parliament from Northern Ireland, the Democratic Unionist Party, opposes,
yes.
Which is, to say the least, it's an unusual position, isn't it, to have your major party oppose the thing that could be most economically advantageous to your area?
Yes, although the DUP would say it is not true to say it creates the best of both worlds. And there are two main reasons for that. Firstly, everybody involved in the creation of the backstop all say it would be temporary. So if we were to try and market Northern Ireland as an investment destination on the basis of the backstop, that might be quite difficult because everybody's saying, well, this great situation is not going to be sustainable for the long term. It's only temporary. The second issue around the backstop is, although there would be no new checks or controls on goods going from Northern Ireland into the rest of the UK, there would be checks and controls on goods coming the other way. Because remember, Northern Ireland effectively becomes the gateway to the single market. That would particularly affect food products. So the supermarket lorries coming into Larne Harbour or Belfast Harbour, which at the moment just roll through unchecked, there would be a situation, some of those lorries would have to be checked, there would have to be documentary checks, some other industrial goods might be subject to new checks and controls, so that starts to add cost and complexity. So the DUP would say it is not the case that the backstop is the economic Shangri-La that it's cracked up to be.
How robust is the Northern Irish economy? In other words, if there were this no-deal Brexit, would it be able to recover, and how long might that take?
It's the short-term disruption which could be particularly damaging for some sectors. So say, for example, the agri-food sector. 15% of all goods which go across the Irish border from Northern Ireland are dairy products. In the event of a no-deal Brexit, those products would be facing an average tariff of 64%. So completely clobbered. The Ulster Farmers Union say effectively Northern Ireland products would be locked out of the EU single market in that scenario. And other manufacturing industries who have quite fine margins, they would find themselves in a very difficult situation.
In your judgment, are the economic stakes as high for the Republic as they are for Northern Ireland, John?
I think what you can say about the Republic's economy is that it is a more globally facing economy than Northern Ireland's, because it's a sovereign country, there are more economic levers to pull. So it's probably easier for that economy to adapt in a more nimble way and to react to the impacts of no deal. For Northern Ireland, it might be more difficult. And adding to the difficulty, of course, is there's no government in Northern Ireland at the moment to actually pull the economic levers that are available.
John Campbell on the economic challenges and opportunities Brexit presents for Northern Ireland and the Republic. Now, the threat of violence aside, what's at stake politically on both sides of the border? I'm joined now from Belfast by political sociologist Katie Hayward and historian Margaret O'Callaghan. They're both from Queen's University. And from Dublin, we're joined by Atain Tanham, a political scientist from Trinity College. Katie Hayward, we've had 20 years of relative peace in Northern Ireland following the Good Friday Agreement. Could you explain in simple terms what the Good Friday Agreement was and why it mattered so much?
So the Good Friday Agreement built on the ceasefires of paramilitary organisations in Northern Ireland, and it came at the end of a series of multi-party talks. So all parties in Northern Ireland were involved, except for the DUP, which excluded itself from that process. And when we came to the agreement in April 1998, we had the British and Irish governments supporting it, and the main parties all agreed on certain things. And this was primarily about viewing the conflict in Northern Ireland as a border conflict. So it saw the primary division within Northern Ireland as being about the existence of the border. So particularly it assumes that there are two main communities in Northern Ireland between Irish nationalists and British unionists. Irish nationalists wanting a closer relationship with the South, ideally for them, a united Ireland. And then, of course, British unionists wanting Northern Ireland to remain in the UK. And the way that the Good Friday Agreement dealt with this was not through resolving that conflict or removing it, but essentially about viewing the border as a point of cooperation, really. So it agreed that unionists and nationalists would share power within Northern Ireland, that there'd be formal cooperation and institutions working across the border on the island of Ireland, and then that the British-Irish relationship could also be formalised through such institutions as the British-Irish Council.
Margaret O'Callaghan, what difference has the Good Friday Agreement made to how people live their lives on the two sides of the border and the way in which they see themselves?
What the Good Friday Agreement does is changes like the architecture of understanding what it is to be a citizen within Northern Ireland. Before the 60s, if you were in Northern Ireland, hopefully you were British, you were loyal, or you were disloyal. So the architecture of the Good Friday Agreement changed that completely, because now you can be a good citizen in Northern Ireland, but you can also have an Irish identity or a British identity. So it made everything more fluid here. It resolved all of the issues of massive opposition to partition that had been strong in nationalist Ireland. And from the southern point of view, it meant that the Irish government removed Articles 2 and 3 of their constitution, which had claimed jurisdiction over Northern Ireland.
That's a very interesting point you make, that it actually makes a psychological difference to how people see themselves.
Yeah, I mean, because when Northern Ireland was established, it was established, if you like, to provide a space and a home for those loyal to Britain in Ireland. And it's been six counties of the province of Ulster. But at the beginning, it was two-thirds unionist, one-third nationalist. Now, what's coincided with the Good Friday Agreement is an alteration of the demographic of Northern Ireland. So now it's almost 50-50. So that's a huge change since the late 90s. On the one hand, there's this notion of equality within Northern Ireland. And on the other hand, the purpose for which Northern Ireland was established, which was a protective safe haven for, if you like, British unionists, is changed by the changing demographics. And that's why Brexit at this time is so difficult for here.
Well, Katie Hayward, taking that point, where would a no-deal Brexit, in other words, we fall out of the European Union, as people term it, where would that leave the Good Friday Agreement? Does it actually affect the agreement itself in any way?
Fundamentally, we have, of course, the fact that the Irish border would then become a customs border and a regulatory border. So you'd have to have checks and controls on the movement of goods across that border. More broadly, however, it would completely change the relationship between Britain and Ireland. And I think regardless of whether we have a no deal or a withdrawal agreement, that relationship is already under pressure, not least because we see the United Kingdom and going in a different direction to Ireland as part of the logic of Brexit. And this, for Northern Ireland being a sort of a meeting point between Britain and Ireland, this puts Northern Ireland in a quite fragile and vulnerable position.
We'll come back to exactly that point in a moment, but I just want to ask Atain Tanim in Dublin, is the European Union actually mentioned in the Good Friday Agreement? Was it a signatory? Was it formally involved?
The European Union was a very significant framework for the whole peace process. John Hume, former leader of the SDLP, emphasised the EU as having a neutral and conflict resolution past a model of cooperation. So in that sense, it was fundamentally important. And yes, it is mentioned explicitly under Strand 2 of the Good Friday Agreement. The institutions that Katie mentioned for cross-border cooperation, the EU is mentioned there, and in the annex of the Good Friday Agreement, it specifies different types of funding, different projects that the EU funds.
Did the European Union's involvement allow the parties in Northern Ireland maybe to do things that they wouldn't have been able to do if the EU hadn't been involved?
Yeah, most definitely. In terms of the EU being a neutral framework, it wasn't British, it wasn't Irish, it was European. So for unionists who would have been very reluctant to cooperate with the Irish government economically or politically or with Irish businesses, the EU enabled it to be a neutral source of funding. It was more palatable to them in that way, that it wasn't coming from an Irish government. It wasn't part of a political ploy to make them part of a united Ireland.
Margaret O'Callaghan, looking at the perspective from Northern Ireland, was the EU's practical involvement of significance in the Good Friday Agreement and its implementation?
The stabilisation of paramilitaries after conflict through funding to have them, you know, set up a whole variety of organisations, that's all European money. But I think its psychological involvement is more central. At the moment, the border feels open. You can be Irish or British here. You go up and down to Dublin. It feels like one place. So from a Northern Nationalist point of view, there's a sense almost of being trapped within whatever this new United Kingdom is going to be.
Well, that's very clear. So, Atain, how invested are the Irish government in Theresa May's deal and the backstop?
Hugely invested. And the week that the withdrawal agreement was agreed and announced was, I would argue, from an Irish perspective down here, very moving, because the Irish diplomats and politicians have been really working on this for the past 18 months, if not 2 years, to get the backstop legally enshrined. And there was great gratitude to Theresa May as well.
Margaret. Some might say that the Irish government have been over-invested in this and have failed to some degree to look at the actualities and realities of the situation. And that is the overwhelming leverage that the DUP have at Westminster. In London, the future of Northern Ireland is being determined, if you like, by the votes of the DUP, which brings us back to the point that the Brexit issue in Northern Ireland politics has become a dividing line between unionists and nationalists. And from an Irish historical point of view, it just shows how British decisions, you know, 1911 initiated a whole decade of instability on this island as a result of Lloyd George's decision to introduce a new budget. But now the whole of this island is destabilised and in turmoil as a result of this decision. And actually, apart from the DUP, no one here has that much control over it.
Katie Heywood, there is a Northern Irish Assembly theoretically in Stormont, have its members not meeting as they are, or the organisation itself had any input whatsoever into the Brexit negotiations?
Well, they never could have done, even if we'd have had the Northern Ireland Assembly up and running. And yes, you're right, it's been suspended now, or effectively suspended, for 2 years. They couldn't have done that because the negotiations always had to be between the UK and the EU. But what we could have seen, I think, if we'd have had the Northern Ireland executive there functioning, would have been a more coherent voice from Northern Ireland. Margaret's very right to point to the power and influence that the DUP has disproportionately at the moment in Westminster, which often takes away from the fact that the majority of parties in Northern Ireland are actually making joint statements vis-a-vis Brexit in particular in support of the withdrawal agreement and the protocol.
So, in other words, if there were a joint Northern Irish approach which used the Assembly as one part of the discussion, it would have had the effect of rebalancing the Northern Irish input into the discussion, because you would have had people, essentially, who had committed to remain, other parties, involved in the process, whereas at the moment it's just the Democratic Unionist Party. Margaret O'Callaghan, do you agree that you could maybe kind of construct something which would give a better Northern Irish voice in the way that Kate is suggesting?
I don't know how you do that, because the actuality at the moment is that the DUP, which represents probably 30% of the people in Northern Ireland, is controlling not just policy for the future of Northern Ireland, but probably policy for the future of the UK. And I don't see, in terms of realpolitik, how you can change that in the present.
Katie Heywood, in practical terms, isn't the lack of any unified Northern Irish voice or a resolved Northern Irish voice a significant problem in operating a backstop?
So the UK government put forward a paper just before the withdrawal agreement was voted on a couple of weeks ago on the 9th of January, saying that it wanted to give the Northern Ireland Assembly more of a voice if it came to implementing the protocol. So it said that if they were looking, though they were going to enter the backstop, then the Northern Ireland Assembly would have a debate and a vote on that. There are some problems with that, not least the fact that will we have the Assembly up and running by then? And more to the point, would we have a singular view coming out from the Northern Ireland Assembly, which is the point that Margaret's been drawing our attention to?
Attain, does the Irish government believe, as some people I think apparently do, that this process has brought the possibility closer of a border poll?
The Irish government is really opposed to raising that issue. Within the framework and the spirit of the Good Friday Agreement, there's a sensitivity to the need to reassure unionists, particularly at the moment, because it's such a destabilising time. So the Irish government's position would be really not to want Irish unification or a border poll to be on the agenda at the moment. And there's been a very good, I think, party support, even sometimes from Sinn Féin across the board, in support of that. Mary Lou MacDonald, when she became leader of Sinn Féin quite recently, said that it was not the time in the midst of the Brexit context to be talking about Irish unification. And Gerry Adams, quite soon after calling for a border poll, said that unification was part of a longer-term strategy.
Margaret O'Callaghan, I did an event in Northern Ireland in the autumn, and it was quite a middle-class event, people who were kind of cross-party. But the one thing that they were all excited by was the possibility of moving towards a border poll. They really did think, some of them, that there was some possibility of this. They weren't Republicans or anything like that, but they just thought this is shifting the tectonic plates a bit. Is that your sense of things?
I think a border poll would be a dreadful idea, but what opinion polls do seem to indicate is that nationalists who were quite happy post the Good Friday Agreement to live in the, you know, kind of neutral space we all felt we were proceeding within, are deeply alienated as a result of the idea of being out of Europe with a hard border. And therefore, they are much more sympathetic and perhaps destabilised enough to look favourably on the idea of reunification. But most people, I don't know where your party or your gathering was, David, but I think most moderate people here at the moment think that a border poll at this stage would be a disaster, because we're so polarised. That would just be terrible.
Margaret O'Callaghan there with Katie Heywood and Attain Tannum. To sum all that up, Brexit has created a set of really difficult problems, not least for the people of the Republic of Ireland who weren't involved in the decision. But one thing we probably shouldn't expect out of it, however, is any great movement towards a vote for a united Ireland. No one needs the aggravation. My thanks to Peter Taylor, John Campbell, Katie Heywood, Margaret O'Callaghan and Attain Tannum. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Helen Grady, Serena Tarling and Kirstine Knight. If you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds. We've built up quite a library.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.